Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Tim.
Yes.
I know yesterday was news, and we're going to get launched in a few minutes and have a conversation with Keith Johnson about demonology and the paranormal. But I got one news story that came across my desk that I don't know exactly where it fits in our pantheon. It's certainly not true crime. It's not really paranormal, but it's... I don't know. Would you consider strings of bad luck kind of paranormal?
I would, yes. Extreme bad luck I consider paranormal, yeah.
All right. Well, I don't know. Maybe you can weigh in on this one, Tim.
Okay.
And, you know, we've got Carl Johnson online with us right now, and maybe he can weigh in on this as having worked in the field of demonology so long, he might know if this is a sign that you've pissed off God or something. But the headline reads, Venomous Spider Bites Australian Man on His Penis Again. A 21-year-old Australian tradesman has been bitten by a venomous spider on a penis for the second time. The man was using a portable toilet on a Sydney building site Tuesday when he suffered a repeat of the incident that happened to him 5 months ago. Jordan, who preferred not to reveal his surname, said he was bitten on pretty much the same spot by the spider. "I'm the most unlucky guy in the country at the moment," he told the BBC. "I was sitting on the toilet doing my business and just felt the sting that I felt the first time. I was like, I can't believe it's happened again. I look down and I've seen a few little legs come out from around the rim." He said that after being bitten the first time, it made him very wary of using portable toilets. "After the first time it happened, I really didn't want to use one again. Toilets got clean that day and I thought it was my opportunity to go use one. Had a look under both seats and then I sat down to do my business. Next thing you know, I'm bent over in raging pain." The tradesman said he was not sure what type of spider bit him this time. One of his colleagues took him from the worksite to Northwest Sydney to Blacktown Hospital. Although many of his workmates were quick to see the lighter side of the situation, they got worried the first time, he said. "This time they were making jokes before I was getting in the car. The hospital declined to discuss the matter, citing patient privacy. Jordan was released from the hospital and is expected to return to work, but was unlikely to be using the on-site toilet in the future. I think I'll be holding on for dear life, to be honest," he said. The red-backed spider, closely related to the black widow spider, is distinguished by a long red stripe on its abdomen. Its bite causes severe pain, sweating, and nausea. Although there are recorded cases of deaths from redbacks, none have occurred since the development of antivenom in 1956.
Oh,
so I don't know if it's a sign of just really bad luck, but to be bitten in the same place by the same spider twice within a few months. I don't know. Carl, do you think the devil's out for this guy or what?
Well, I can empathize because I had an appointment with a urologist just yesterday. And, you know, I didn't present the same problem, but I mean, it just brought it to mind, you know, like, well, I should have asked more questions while I was there. I've never been to a urologist before, but, you know.
I like that you're equating your visit with a urologist with a man being bitten on his junk by a poisonous spider, Carl.
Yeah, but I wasn't bitten.
I know, luckily.
Well.
Yeah. I wonder if it led to any obtuse. Any like pronounced swelling or anything, because there could be advantages in this, you know, depending on how long it lasts.
Oh, good grief.
Well, I mean, Carl, after 4 hours, you got to call about that spider bite. You know?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. Carl Johnson is back. It's been a while since we visited. I think one of the last times we visited was on our Edgar Allan Poe show. I think we had you stop on and you did a show with us on that. He's got a new book called Shadow Realms, the Demonology Handbook. And in the book, he has articles by both Carl Johnson and Lana Brock. Carl is known probably most for his appearances on Sci-Fi Channel's Ghost Hunters season 1 and 2. in Animal Planet's The Haunted in 5 episodes. He also appeared in an episode of A Haunting with his family. And it's good to have you back, Carl. It's nice to check in with you and see how you're doing.
We swap messages online, but I haven't really had a chance to really chat with you in a while. So nice to hear you.
It's been quite a while. So let's catch up. Now, the new book is out and available, and you've got articles in there talking, I'm sure, about your work in the field of demonology. And a lot of people may not know this. Certainly, it wasn't touched on in the movie, but your brother Keith, your twin brother Keith, and you were the really the first investigators on site at the Conjuring story, right? The Perrin family. You were the initial investigators in on that case.
Yes, that is accurate. It goes back to that was August and September 1973. I was a Cub Scout. No, I was a member of a group based at Rhode Island College called PIRO, Parapsychology Investigation Research Organization. We were contacted by a Carolyn Perrin, and she invited us to come and explore their farmhouse, which had some strange activity there. And it was everything it was cracked up to be. And so we were members of that team. And Keith and I actually initiated that investigation. We were involved with them for 2 months. And then my brother conceived of the idea of inviting in Ed and Lorraine Warren, the noted ghost hunters with whom we were acquainted. So what we didn't know is that Ed and Lorraine would totally take over the case, you know, before we knew it. And we were going to be working with them. But it was an interesting time, and I still have good memories of that era. You know, and when I saw the movie The Conjuring, I wasn't going to see it, but, you know, I thought, it's nothing I don't know. But I actually felt kind of nostalgic watching that movie. Yeah, but we initiated that investigation and called in Ed and Lorraine Warren, and that is actually how the parents became acquainted with Ed and Lorraine.
How did, when you're in there and actually investigating this, you know, there was a lot, and it looked very dark and malevolent, kind of haunting that was taking place there. Now, hearing Andrea Perrin and her father, they seemed to think it was a much lighter source. When you and your brother first came to investigate this, kind of, you know, just to remind people, what was it really like? To give us the actual experience, not Hollywood's version, was it dark, negative energy forces? Was it threatening, violent? What really took place?
No, actually, it seemed kind of homey. It didn't seem like it was going to drive anybody out of their house. They just wanted this investigator to find, you know, get to the root of it. There were some dark things happening out in the barn. You got a really bad feeling out there and black shadowy forms there. But when I first came to the Perrins, I remember we were interviewing the family and the girls, and I heard moving around upstairs, and I asked at a point in the interview, I said, who's somebody upstairs? And they said, oh, no, we hear that from time to time. We just hear, you know, like as if there were other people living here, but they're not. So I kind of backed off and went upstairs without announcing I was going upstairs. And I just, you know, started probing up there. And I was standing in the hallway. And then I saw out of the corner of my eye, my right eye, out of my peripheral vision, I saw this black cloud coming down the hallway. My first impression was, oh, there's a fire in the house. I'm going to smell smoke. But this dark cloud rolled down the hallway and it just enveloped me. I closed my eyes reflexively. When I opened my eyes, it dissipated, you know, and that's the first thing I saw. And later that same day, there was one of the bedrooms upstairs, and it was August. It was sweltering outside, but that room was like a freezer. And a window was open, so that, you know, why would it be so cold there? They didn't have any air conditioning on. And I tried to close that window. It was jammed open. They said, no, this room is always, always cold. My brother tried an experiment. He started reciting a psalm from the Bible. And right then, one of the girls was like, heard a slap sound, and she had finger marks on her face, and the window slammed closed. Boom! So there were things happening in that house while we were there. I went down to explore the basement. Nobody else wanted to go down there. Keith and I went down there, though. And I remember I was down in the basement, and that basement is illustrated in the movie. So I'm there, and there's one light bulb hanging from a cord, and that light bulb just went out while I was down there, and I didn't have a flashlight with me, and why, I don't know, but I was just down there, and all of a sudden the light bulb goes out. If you can imagine a 17-year-old Carl just in the dark saying, oh, shit, you know. But I felt my way over to the stairs and
imagine.
Things were happening. Yeah, so it was active even the first night we were there. And during those months, there was Carolyn Perrin would be calling me like 12 times a day sometimes. And she'd be telling me the latest thing that happened, like she was slicing an orange, blood, what looked like blood spilled out of the orange onto her feet. She was calling me and updating me on everything. And I remember, of course, I was living at my parents' home, and my father said, "Who is this woman that keeps calling you? Is this a girlfriend?" And I said, "Not exactly, Dad." So it was interesting. And then suddenly we stopped hearing from Carolyn and didn't hear from her for 3 weeks. And then she called back and told us that the Warren surprised them, her and her husband, that they couldn't do any good unless they were the only investigators there. You know, they said, "We're just a bunch of kids. We couldn't help them out." So, but, you know, over the years, especially my brother has stayed in touch with the Perrin family. We have good relations with them and all that. But it was an interesting time. It didn't end the way it's illustrated in the movie, but I don't need to go into all the details. But,
right. I think everybody knows that was pretty Hollywoodized.
It was very much so, very much so. It was scripted. Well, they had to have a definite beginning and an ending. You know, they had to have closure. There was really no closure. The parents were not driven out. Andrea Perrin's books, it's a series of three books. They're titled House of Light, House of Darkness, because they had loving, warm times there in that house as well. They weren't driven out. They're not going to, you know, forsake all their investment. So, but they had some pretty spooky things happening there.
Well, knowing what you know about demonology and that realm, do you believe that, you know, what exactly takes place in those situations? You know, when you've got seemingly dark and light presences coexisting, do you believe that the dark presence, the more malevolent, really has nothing to do with the demons? It might just be an angry or irritated spirit of a human?
I think there are resonance. I think that buildings, the materials the buildings construct of, especially if it's a home, it absorbs memories. It has a capacity to remember. And under special circumstances, which we don't fully understand, sometimes those memories are replayed. It's like embedding information into a computer chip, in a sense, that those memories linger. They remain, and sometimes they just come out like holographic. They're, you know, I'm kind of sounding like a materialist here, but I don't think it's always that the spirit has unfinished business and, you know, has right. to be moved into the light. Maybe that's not doing them any favor if you help a spirit move into the light. And that old farmhouse did have a lot of memories it was replaying. And you do get that strange dichotomy sometimes where it seems like there's a harmless, nice spirit just wants to be there, and there's a more malevolent presence, and they seem to be battling each other. And how much that is rooted in reality, I can't know. But sometimes you'll get something dark and then something that seems harmless. And as a demonologist, often Keith and I have been called into a situation where it will start off where the child is seeing a spirit, and it's a friendly spirit. It's a nice man, or it's a nice friendly lady. And then something changes and the spirit isn't friendly anymore. And typically the child will say, you know, "This lady scared me. She had sharp teeth, and when she smiled, and her eyes were all black." So it seems to have changed or revealed itself as something malevolent. Then the parents start seeing it, and that's when we're called in. A lot of the paranormal teams don't want to address that themselves, so they'll call in a demonologist, which supposedly we have a lot of answers. But well, every case, is, every hopes, situation right? is unique. Yeah, that's what we hoped for. But of course, every situation is so unique that you don't know till you get there. And that's what I try to address in the demonology handbook, Shadow Realms.
Well,
if you have
taking
any questions
a look
about the book.
Yeah, I do. And that's what I wanted to get into. I just wanted to make sure
that
we covered a little bit about The Conjuring. So in the book,
I always like to talk about that.
Yeah. Talk to us about the book, the type of articles, you know, the experiences you've had, and becoming a demonologist is not something that's just you read a few books and become a demonologist. You and your brother have dedicated your lives to the study and aid and help of people in these really serious situations. What are some of the points that you talk about most in the book?
Well, misconceptions mostly about what demons are and what they could be, that you know, people divide this as typically people or let's say in particular paranormal researchers, paranormal investigators divide the categories into spirits, like human generated spirits, and demons. But it's very hard, if not impossible, to actually delineate the two, because they have, you know, they do similar things. It's generally called a demon when it starts creating problems and, you know, like throwing things. I mean, that could be a poltergeist too.
But I cover that, and we talk about what somebody might do and what they really shouldn't do if they're addressing what is decided to be a demonic situation. And this is through trial and error myself. I'm just saying, like, some of these things, you know, I've made errors along the way. Don't let this happen to you. You know, I assumed too much, or, you know, but this time I stood my ground and, you know, was glad I did in retrospect. I give some of my own personal history in this, you know, what I've run into and what seems most effective. The design of the book is intended to be like a handbook that something someone can bring into a paranormal investigation and maybe have it in their briefcase or their backpack and pull it out and research that. You know, like, oh, do they have a chapter on this? Look in the index. Is there something on this? Maybe we can address that. You know, so I want it to be just like a friendly book that, you know, you just have as part of your arsenal. You know, that's why it's called Handbook. And there's a lot of theory and speculation. And that's where Lana Brock comes in, my co-author, because she's she has a degree in theology. She's an accredited theologist, and she's studying about, you know, diabolism, demonology, and angelology, and actually an academic environment. She studied these things, so she has a lot of theory and speculation too, and some of her case histories. So together,
Yeah, I'm curious about the mistakes. You know, what are some of the mistakes you've made going into these situations?
Basically, going in unprepared has been a problem before. You know, like, well, they've got a situation. Let's just check it out. And I like to meditate and prepare psychologically, like build up my defenses through prayer, through meditation, through just an awareness of my own strengths and limitations before I go into a situation. And I didn't always do that enough. Sometimes I would just go in like, oh, let's see what's happening. And then you're confronted with something really horrific. One case in point was the possession of Lucas, it's called. And I had mentioned that in the book. It was a case that transpired way back in 1980. It was not too long after The Conjuring involvement. And this was in Providence, Rhode Island, and there was a 14-year-old boy named Lucas. I like to say we'll call him Lucas because that was his name. And he was undergoing fits, which I thought maybe he's having some kind of epileptic seizure and they're interpreting it as a possession. So I was invited to stay overnight at this house. It was a 3-story house in the west end of Providence. And I knew the family. They're of Dominican Republic and Puerto Rican heritage. So, and then, of course, they embrace a belief in spiritual intervention, spiritualism. And I stayed overnight at the house, and I was on the boys, outside of the boys' bedroom on the third floor. And it was around 1 a.m, and I was reclining on a settee. And then around 1 o'clock in the morning, all of a sudden, I was just drifting off down to sleep. And all of a sudden, I heard this horrific scream, a shrill scream. So I ran and fumbled for the light switch, turned on the light. And the boy's bedroom door opened by itself, and his body was flung out of the room and started spinning around the floor like a top very rapidly.
Whoa.
And you couldn't even explain it away by accelerated muscular motor performance. He was just spinning around, careening off the walls, you know, like a cue ball, like pong, pong. And I was just standing there transfixed. I'd never seen anything like that, of course. And I'm thinking, this can't be. This isn't happening, but it is. And then he flew with like the preternatural speed. He just jumped onto the sofa I had been on, and he started to jump up and down, and this harsh guttural laughter came out of his mouth. His eyes were wide and wild. So he went to jump off the couch. I tried to restrain him. I was my normal 200+ pounds. And I put my weight onto holding him down, and he just pushed me right off. Then he came to himself, but he was terrified, this young boy, and crying for his uncle. I mean, even if it wasn't for what I had just witnessed, I knew this was no performance. This was genuine. So an exorcism was arranged. It was actually an expulsion, which is a minor form of exorcism, and there was clergy present, and that was a horrific scene. Lasted about nearly 3 hours, but the boy was better after that. It was successful. Psychological aspects play into this, of course, but there was also very much the supernatural, if you will.
When you see something that dramatic take place right in front of you, Carl, I mean, does that you know, when you realize, boy, whatever this energy is, I mean, it has the power to just toss somebody around like a rag doll and spin them like a top. Maybe I should just, you know, stick to rock and roll music and you know, hanging out with my friends, not doing this kind of work. What keeps you moving forward, knowing how violent, you know, and scary it can be?
All of that went through my mind at the time. I said, I should probably bow out. You know, I mean, I'll stay a few more minutes just to make it look like I wasn't driven out, but I should go home tonight. And I said, you know, I just this feeling I don't belong here. This is supernatural. This is bad stuff. But there's another thought process, you know, concurrent, that I'm thinking, if I leave now, I'm going to shatter these people's faith that anybody can help them. I'm supposed to be able to address these things. And I wasn't being called a demonologist then, but they knew I was somebody who would stand their ground in tense situations. So I said, no, I want to instill some confidence into these people. I'm here to help. You know, I may not know exactly what I'm doing or what I'm going to do, but I've got to be a presence here. I've got to discuss this with them. We've got to arrange something to help. So I'm like, you know, I got to do this. This is my, you know, my moment of truth. Either I leave now and don't come back, or I stick around and see it through. So that was a formative period. And that was, I probably should have prepared more, but I don't know how I could have prepared for what I witnessed in that house, that and other things. But I probably should have meditated more and been, you know, more reinforced and, you know,
right. Are you ever really truly prepared for that kind of case, though? I mean, it seems like
not really,
you know,
no.
It could. Yeah, it can do and be whatever it wants to be, no matter how well fed or underfed or well meditated you are. The power that you're battling has its own will and its own desire to do what it wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the it's the element of the unexpected. You can prepare so much, but then again, it's a good idea not to feel you're overly prepared, because then something could throw you for a loop if you hit something unexpected like that. You know, I think I would have reacted the same anyway. I would have stood my ground, or, you know, and felt like I really shouldn't be there, no matter how much I prepared. I just probably would have researched more and interviewed them more thoroughly. The whole situation with that boy started when he was walking through a local cemetery in the West End of Providence, and he found a woman's glove on the ground in the cemetery. He picked it up and brought it home with him, and that's when things started. You know, there's got to be a connection there, I figure. But yeah, if you're overly prepared, you know, if you fasted and, you know, spent much time in prayer and meditation, then something happens. Wait a minute, I wasn't prepared for this. You know, nobody booked this. So then it's
that maybe an attachment from just going through a cemetery?
It seems like it. That would be the logical conclusion, because nothing was happening to him before then. But that set up a lodestone in the boy's mind, too, because he brought home an object from a cemetery, and then he started to get an apparition in his bedroom. So probably a connection. There's a lot of the unknown involved, so we'll never know what really originated it. But there are other factors where the psychological aspects come in. He was from that culture. He was born in New York, but his family was Puerto Rican, and they were they had their own set of spiritual beliefs that you can anger spirits, that spirits must be banished, and they were brought up to believe that. And on the island, that's true, because at one point I did spend 4 months in Puerto Rico and saw some interesting things there that couldn't be easily explained. And they embraced that belief in spirit communication. Also, the boy is 13 and 14 when this is happening. So that's a transitional age, a formative time. You know, he's an adolescent, which could help to explain what seemed to be poltergeist activity in that house. So a lot comes into it. You know, and he was going through adolescent identity crisis, I would think. But then there are things you can't explain away by the psychology. So right. Both factors came into play.
Now, when you go to a country other than, you know, America, where you understand it's primarily Christian, or it's, you know, you understand the faith behind the system, and you go somewhere else and there's this type of activity taking place, is it a whole new set of rules, Carl? Do you have to prepare a different way when you go to battle with people of different belief systems in different countries?
I found that it was, because I went to a Santeria service when I was in Puerto Rico, and I wasn't prepared for people sitting around with candles burning in a darkened room and chanting in the language I didn't understand, you know, and things happen that shouldn't happen there. I saw a levitation happen. I saw people getting taken over by, supposedly taken over by a spirit, and the spirit's communicating through them. Yeah, that's just nothing I'd been exposed to before, so it is different. You know, it's like what would work in, say, in Providence, Rhode Island, or Harrisville, Rhode Island, wouldn't necessarily apply in Bayamon, Puerto Rico. So, yeah, it's a different culture, and I haven't traveled that extensively, but, you know, with the paranormal investigating, I have been to the different states. But once you get into, like, South America and Central America or Europe, which I have not had the experience of yet. Yeah, it's a different culture, different mindset, different set of spiritual beliefs. So you find out when you get there, basically.
Right. And once you get there, does the manifestations, the looks, do they differ in these different cultures, or
you know,
does
there
it all
are
appear
strangely,
kind of the same way?
Yeah, strangely and conversely, there are commonalities in spirit manifestations. You know, what happens in the States can also happen in the British Isles and Europe. The ghosts seem to be ghosts. They are. They may be different cultural references and names applied to them. But yeah, a poltergeist is a poltergeist, and the demon is called a demon wherever. And they may apply different names to it, but it will function the same way. It throw things around, oppress people. Like the case of Annalise over in Germany, which, you know, the possession of Emily Rose was taken from that true account. That was, in many ways, what one would think is a typical demonic assault and possession. And yet that was in, you know, Europe. And the same thing will happen in the United States. Even in, you know, African cultures, there's a, you know, there will be possession, and they have their own rites and rituals to drive away the invading spirits. So there are common features. In demonology, one finds that especially, you know, so the cultural approach is different, but manifestations, there are like features.
Okay. And when dealing and, you know, aiding people in these situations, you talked about the Annalise story. Obviously, we know that ended very poorly. How bad is the risk for people that are dealing with possession? I mean, is the possibility of death rare, or is it a lot more common?
If unaddressed, there, that's always that potential that somebody could actually die from this, and, you know, this possession. If it's not addressed, that is rare, as you say. I mean, it's rare where somebody will actually succumb to possession. But if it's not addressed, if nobody intervenes on the person's behalf, yeah, the subject who's possessed is capable of some extreme actions, and just starving themselves or flinging themselves out a window, you know, and it's a cry for help, something.
I meant more along the lines of during the exorcism.
That's what happened. Yes, there is. There is. I have to say that there is, and it is rare, but I do see that, you know, this is a life-threatening situation at times when a person is going through those violent gyrations, what appear to be seizures. You know, if this, there should be some medical professional, if not present, then addressed. And there is often, maybe not always, but often the possibility that the person will die during the exorcism, because it becomes violent. It becomes intense, driving out a spirit, and the spirit's resisting. And it's a very physical process as well as the spiritual. So it's nothing to be taken lightly.
Have you ever been
present?
Which is
why they recommended demonology.
Right. Have you ever been present for one that ended in death, or have you been lucky to dodge that bullet?
I've dodged it so far, yeah. However, with the one I mentioned that transpired in Providence back in 1980, that could have been a fatal situation had it not been addressed. I thought it would be at some times. With what that boy was going through, to see his neck swell like that and his eyes bulging and his blood pressure skyrocketing. Yeah, of course, that could have been fatal. So I've seen something that could have been fatal in the end, but have not witnessed somebody actually die during an exorcism.
The book is called Shadow Realms Demonology Handbook. It's available, and we do have a link for it on today's program. We have to take a quick break. Before we do, though, it's time the theater of the mind.
Today's theater of the mind comes from the real experiences of Luke, the babysitter. When I was 16 years old, babysitting was an additional source of income, and I was lucky enough to have many families in my area that needed a babysitter. A lady that I babysat for quite often asked me one day if I would mind caring for her sister's baby. She mentioned that her sister had a hard time keeping a babysitter, so of course I thought it was probably due to the actions of the child. If only. I didn't mind at all. I quickly accepted the job, meaning more income for myself, and she was a super nice lady. However, her husband was, well, a real jerk. He didn't want to be bothered with the baby at all, and he was always in a mood. But for the most part, he was gone quite a bit. My first day, she made a point to tell me that the house was quirky, making a lot of strange noises and whatnot. She said, "It's just an old house, it's just settling," but she told me to call her if I had any problems. I thought that was strange, but dismissed it as just being a little overprotective, as this was the first time she'd be leaving her baby with a brand new sitter. My first week was pretty uneventful. A few weird noises, knocks, maybe footsteps, but I quickly dismissed them. One distinctive thing that I remember about the house was that it was always dark, even on the brightest day. It was always really dark. During the day, you still needed to have lights on, even with the curtains open. The baby, who was about 8 months old, had a cute rainbow nightlight. It was one of those older ones that you manually had to switch on or off, and you had to use some force to get the clicker to work. Well, once it lightened up some in the morning, I would go in and turn off the nightlight. Well, morning came, and I turned off the nightlight. I went out to the living room to catch up on some homework. And as soon as I got settled, the baby began screaming. I rushed to his room. He was hysterical. And the nightlight was on. As if that wasn't chilling enough, the baby, wide-eyed and hysterical, continued to point behind me to the corner of the room. I turned, but there was nothing there. At least nothing I could see. Now, I know for a fact that I'd turned off that nightlight. It wasn't a mistake or something. I thought I did. I mean, I played it over and over in my mind again and again. I know that I turned that nightlight off. I took the baby and comforted him. I was so disoriented and scared, I didn't even try to turn off the light again. I thought, if something wants it on, I'm just going to leave it on. I picked him up from the crib and tried to calm him down, when all of a sudden, one of his musical toys with lights began to go off. Of course, I jerked with a gasp, and that made him even more unsettled. "Hey, let's go hang out in the living room, little buddy," I said to him, trying to be as reassuring as I could. I know he felt uneasy being left alone, and the feeling was mutual. I didn't tell the mother about that nightlight. Every day she would come and ask me if everything was okay, and I knew she wasn't just talking about her son. Over the next few weeks, the experiences came more and more often. Lights turning on and off by themselves. Doors would slowly open and then close themselves to the point of latching themselves shut. All of the events finally came to a peak when I was in the kitchen mixing oatmeal for the baby one day. I had that feeling I was being watched, and the feeling grew larger and closer. The hairs on my neck began to stand straight up, and from out of nowhere, someone or something leaned in. I could feel its hot breath against my neck and ear, and it growled. Then, from behind, something tugged the bottom of my shirt, and tugged it hard. It was so hard that my shirt tightened around my neck. I turned around, and no one was there. I screamed and ran into the living room, where the baby stared at me from his high chair like I was crazy. I didn't tell his mother about this either. I don't know why I didn't tell her. Maybe I was afraid I'd lose my job, or she'd just think I was crazy. Finally, she and her husband moved out of that house that fall, making their stay only 10 months. I was the only babysitter who managed to be permanent during that time, and I never discussed the events that happened there. Later, I did some research on the area. It's incredibly rural and as southern as you can get. It also has a rich history in Native American tribes. While looking up the house, I discovered that during its construction, evidence had been unearthed of a full Native American burial site. All I know is that whatever or whomever was there was not happy we were there. That's for sure.
Beyond the darkness.
And we're back. I hope you enjoyed today's Theater of the Mind. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. This is Beyond the Darkness. And we could use your help. My son is raising money for the Polar Plunge, and that is to raise awareness and much-needed funds for the Special Olympics. So if you could help us by going over to darknessradio.com, scrolling to the bottom of the page, you'll see the banner there. You can click on it and make a donation any size, and it will go a long way to help. When we raise this money, and we're shooting for $5,000 this year, the money goes to help Special Olympians with their uniforms, training, travel expenses, and more. So if you could just go to darknessradio.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, you'll see the Polar Plunge banner there. For those of you unfamiliar with the Polar Plunge, here in Minnesota, they will cut a large hole in the ice, in the water, in March. And people will line up, believe it or not, to jump into the freezing cold water. But it is to do a very amazing thing and help out a great cause with the Special Olympics. My son is a Minnesota firefighter and goes with his group from the firehouse he's established at. And they do a lot of great work, and the team helps raise thousands upon thousands of dollars. But Cliff, my son, has always raised the most. So we'd like to keep that moving. And if you could make that donation now, please make your way over to darknessradio.com. Scroll to the bottom of the page. Any size, $1, $5, $10, $20, $1 million. Tim, if you're willing to give $1 million, go ahead and do it right now, Tim.
I don't have $1 million, Dave.
Tim, $1 million would be good, Tim. Just get the ball rolling with $1 million. Could you do that for me?
I don't have $1 million, Dave. Yeah.
I see how you are. Well, all right. Any size, Tim. You know, $500,000 would be good too.
I don't have $500,000, Dave. I wish I did, but I don't. I don't have.
All right. Well, Tim will obviously get us started with $250,000 for his donation. Because he doesn't have one or a $500,000. Yeah, so $250,000 will do, Tim. That'll work.
Yeah, I don't even really have $250,000, Dave.
Unbelievable.
I know.
Unbelievable.
I failed you once again. Yeah.
Hey, any size donation does help. $30 puts a child through an 8-week Special Olympics young athlete season. $60 provides an eye examination and a pair of glasses for two Special Olympic athletes. If we raise $100, it sends a unified pair of ALP University Special Olympic Athlete Leadership Programs. $250 implements a respect campaign into a school, business, and organization. Every $500 provides funding to start a brand new Special Olympics delegation. So you can see the money goes a long way to help, and it's very easy to do. So thank you very much for your love and concern. Go make those donations now. All right, we're back. Our guest today is Carl Johnson, and the book he has written and has been released is called Shadow Realms Demonology Handbook. And this, you said, is literally a book that people could take on site with them if they're dealing with something they think may be demonic, so some force of evil, and kind of work through it to understand what they're dealing with and how to go about taking care of that. Now, if you don't have any real background in demonology, is this book a good starting point for you, Carl?
Yes, I just wanted to say that Tim couldn't donate $1 million to Special Olympics only because he donated that last year.
Right, exactly.
Oh, thanks, Carl. Yeah, exactly. Now I understand. Yeah, now, don't exactly. help him out, Carl. Don't help him.
Thanks, Carl.
Yeah. Don't encourage him.
That's right.
Don't enable him. Yeah. Well, there's about the book, it's that's what I actually intended it to be. And it's a paperback. To my knowledge, there's no hardcover edition at this point. It's just something people can bring with them. I would like someone to read the whole book, and people do. But if somebody wants a quick reference on how to address a situation, this might provide some help, something the person might not have thought of. And I'd had time to sit and write the book. Say, oh, yeah, I could have done this better. Or, yeah, I remember that technique was successful in that situation. So that's what I intended it to be, a quick reference. That's why I have an index in it. the back. And procedure, like, you know, what to do and what not to do in some situations. And different approaches people take to banishing a spirit. By the way, it's notoriously difficult to banish a demon or a spirit. You know, you, if it's what we call a human-generated ghost, a spirit, then you can ask the spirit to leave, and 8 or 9 times out of 10, it will leave or will lessen the infestation. If it's a demonic, they may retreat, but they come back with compound vengeance. And it's very difficult to banish one. It's more like wearing it down and getting rid of it. And I address that in the book. So if somebody has that book with them and it's in their supply box when they're on a situation and involved in an investigation, I just think it's nice to have that along. It gives a different perspective. There's some items and some issues that people may not have thought of while they were, you know,
and you've got, I know,
on
you've
the
got
investigation.
A myriad of stories to share and talk about.
I do.
So let's launch into another one of your examples, one of the times that you've been in dealing with this. And do they start off slow for you as well? People will tell you, oh, my God, this is going on. You get there and you think, oh, I think they're over exaggerating. And then all of a sudden, literally all hell breaks loose.
Yes, it varies. General premise would be where, you know, it seems to be hiding. I will say that, you know, that doesn't mean your house isn't haunted. They're just kind of hiding away now because they might be aware, the spirits might be aware that the investigating team is here. But there were a couple of instances where things just broke right out while we were there. And, it can start happening, I find, during the interview process while we're sitting with the folks, the family, you know, homeowners, and talking about their situation and what's transpired there, and then start hearing things in the next room. Nobody's in the next room. I see a chair move or something. Now, those are pretty modest results, but there have been times. One was in a case, a 3-story brownstone home in Brooklyn, New York. Another one was a private residence in Coventry, Rhode Island. And these were instances where right while the investigating team was there, things would happen. Objects would fly around, crockery, sugar bowls flying around the house. And that's gold to a paranormal investigator. But
but to the people afflicted with it, not so much, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, thank you. We'll come back. You know, like, well, we have to live with this. We have to sleep here tonight. Well, can't help you with that unless you want us to stay the night, you know, you'll feed us, you know. But in that case in Brooklyn, it involved a disappearing person. One facet of this case, my brother had his trusty cassette recorder with him, and he was recording. And during the interview, we heard a male voice intone the name Beatrice. You know, just heard Beatrice, you know, that's an uncommon name these days. And we asked the homeowner and her cousin, you know, we uncovered the name Beatrice. Does this mean anything to you? They didn't know, but the lady, the homeowner's cousin, they were more like sisters, but they're cousins. And she asked her mother about Beatrice. Does anybody in the family named Beatrice? Do we know anybody named Beatrice? And the mother reacted. She said, who's been talking to you? How do you know that name? Well, it turned out the homeowner's father had was running a speakeasy in that house. And he had a mistress. He was kind of a criminal character. Oh, I don't know if I want to say criminal. Let's just say a shady character. And he had a mistress, and the mistress was a missing person. She suddenly disappeared under very strange circumstances and was never heard from again. It was thought that she'd become pregnant, and it was convenient for her to disappear. So maybe he was a criminal. And the woman's name was Beatrice. So that was just uncovered. You know, they'd have no, in that house, they had no way of knowing who that name. And that was remarkable. And I stayed several nights in that house, and I would hear moving around in the house, like somebody was in the kitchen moving chairs around. I'd go in there, nobody would be there. But the homeowner's cousin, she, while we were sitting there, she was wearing a crucifix with beads, like rosary beads, and that was just pulled off her neck while we were there. And in the house in Coventry, Rhode Island, that was, they actually were driven out of that house. They vacated because of the activity there. And the house was only like 20 years old at the time, 22 years old. A sugar bowl went, my first night there, the sugar bowl went flying across the room and smashed on a post. And a chair I was sitting in went backwards all the way to the wall with me sitting in it. I was holding it. We were in the master bedroom, which seemed to be one of the centers of paranormal activity. And I saw, I just happened to glance to the right, and I saw a knife coming down the hallway. And the knife hit the temperature, the remote thermal gauge I was holding. Didn't hit my hand, but it hit that gauge I was holding and fell on the floor. But it wasn't like, you know, like a knife throw where it's got spinning. It was coming straight, you know, straight at me. And I didn't have I was startled, but I didn't have a chance to be frightened. It was too fast. I was actually kind of flattered that it picked me. And I think it could have hit my hand or my arm, but it hit, you know, oh, me again, yes. And, oh, and in that master bedroom, we were discussing
Carl,
the case.
You're all kinds of special, Carl, when you're excited that they chose to throw the knife at you.
Yes, when I hit that pothole last night, I thought I was pretty special. Like, why me? Me? It had to be me that went into this.
So you're confusing the other side, Carl. It doesn't know what you want to be rewarded with, flying knives, potholes.
Yeah. What just letting you know, we're thinking about you. Yeah. Oh, and in that same house, a dinner plate appeared over my head and smashed. It just transported. It was there, and it smashed in front of me. You know, so I kind of said, oh, maybe it has something to do with me. I don't know. Maybe it knows I'm specialized as a demonologist. I don't know. Or maybe I reminded it of somebody, but the dinner plate smashed in front of me, and
do you ever have
ladies
concerns?
In the room screamed.
Do you ever have concerns the fact that, all right, it's not, you know, you go in prepared, you go in protected, you deal with this. Obviously, it still tries to attack you, but do you ever have concerns that it might go after loved ones, your loved ones? If it can't get to you, will it try to attack somebody else that you love and care about?
Yes, I have, very much so. Well, there was one of our team in that when we were addressing the case in Coventry. It's the Marin's case. You know, I can say that they moved to another state. They don't own the house anymore. When we were involved with the Marin's case, and this was 11 years ago, and one of the team members was Laura, and I was afraid that she was becoming vulnerable because her mood would change. It was very much unlike her. She usually was pretty well put together and stable seeming. And, but she was changing as we became more involved with investigating this case. And I thought it was going after her. And I must say, I don't know how involved it was with that, situation, but she never recovered from that. She was different after our involvement with that case. Her personality changed. She was much more, her anxiety was taking hold and depression set in that seemed unfamiliar to her. So, I think it was targeting her, and I am concerned about the people around me. As far as attacking my mother or something, which I still have my mother, and, we had some haunted activity in our house, and that was, showcased in that episode of a haunting. They show our family story about the haunted activity in the house because my mother doesn't remember most of it. She didn't remember it like 2 weeks after things would happen. Nah, I don't know. But yeah, I was concerned that somebody would get hit in the face with something or more like some psychological influence and damage
right. That's
happened with that investigator, Laura. You know, she just never seemed the same after that. And because we did overnights in this house, and I remember this Laura, she kept exotic birds. She was familiar with them. And the homeowner, the lady of the house, she had two lovebirds, but she wasn't keeping them very clean. So Laura was cleaning off the cage while we were doing one of these overnights, overnight meaning till 3 or 4 in the morning. And Laura spoke to the bird. She said, "How you doing, babies?" And I was recording at the time, played back the recording after we left. And you hear Laura's voice say, "How you doing, babies?" And this female voice said, "Dying." Like EVP, electronic voice phenomena, where a voice is imprinted on a recording and play it back later and hear it. So we didn't hear that intoned at the time. But Laura's saying, "How you doing, babies?" while she's cleaning the cage. And the female disembodied voice says, "Dying." Within a week and a half, both of those birds were dead.
Oh, so no.
That kind of rocked the experience. And in that same house, the lead investigator was we were performing our investigation in the kitchen, the big kitchen area. And I suggested, I said, ask if it misses the homeowner, Tina. I said, ask if it misses Tina, because they had left the house so we could investigate for the night. And so the lead investigator said, do you like Tina? Do you want Tina home? Okay, I'm playing back the recording. I'm listening to about 90 minutes of recording, and I'm just about ready to call it a night. Towards the end of the recording here, the lead investigator, she says, do you like Tina? Do you want Tina home? And a male voice comes out. It's like a sibilant, like whisper. I played it again and listened, and what the voice says was, oh, yeah, I'd like to boil Tina.
Oh, my gosh.
This was a horrific haunting. And, you know, one thing to talk about it, and it's kind of chilling now to recount it, but to be there in that house and see, like, the chandelier shaking on its own and hear footsteps walk right by you. Oh, it's sugar bowl crockery flying around. That was an intense case. But it was never fully resolved, and then we'll say the homeowners did not really take our advice either.
I was going to ask that. I mean, you know, a lot of these people, are they looking for just corroboration to prove that they're not insane, that these things are happening, and they don't mind
sometimes
that these things stay?
In this case, well, they wanted it out. They wanted it gone, especially the lady of the house. And but that Christmas, she had her family over, and her brother was taunting her. Say, you say your house is haunted. I don't think there's anything here. She said, oh, no, I'll show you. And she started calling for the spirit to show him. And then he got some banging on the wall. But more things happened after the guest left. You know, so that was unwise of her. And she came from the Azores, the Portuguese Azores. And you know, so she had been brought up in an environment of spirit communication. She and her sister had owned 10 Ouija boards. Three of them they burned, the other seven were lost. So, you know, it's like you're inviting, you're trying to put out the fire with kerosene here, you know, kind of history. So, but they did really want this influence gone. They would act unwisely at times. But yeah, sometimes people don't want it to go. They want a team, a more or less professional team, to come in and adjudicate and say, yeah, this, you have a haunting here. This is the real McCoy. But more often the person wants it addressed and wants it out of there, or the family unit wants the presence gone. There's no surefire formula for that. It can irritate a spirit or a demon to the point where it departs, but it usually is a longer process. It's not an overnight remedy.
Are you surprised by the fact, you know, the Vatican is doing so much more training? There are more, more and more exorcists that are being released into the United States. It sounds like you're talking about free-range chickens, but you know, they're actually taking, it seems they're taking it a lot more seriously. Is that because of the demand that the churches just can't handle all the crazy people who think they're possessed, or do you think there might be some kind of rise in dark energy right now?
It seems to be on the increase. Well, we'll look at the factors. You know, like conflicts in the world theater are escalating. There are more human beings on the planet. I think we've got more than 7 billion of us crawling around the surface of the planet now. And there's more of a recognition of spiritual realities. And it's interesting that in the so-called age of enlightenment, when there has been progression in psychology and the medical fields, there's still a call for the exorcists. They're still training priest in the rite of exorcism and the procedures of exorcism. You know, as we learn more, there's also an increased call for addressing spiritual problems and driving out evil spirits. You know, does that mean we haven't progressed so far, or maybe there's an influx? Maybe there are more demons on the planet now because there are more people, and the demons feel they have to address that.
Yeah, very well could be. I guess that's an interesting aspect I hadn't considered before.
Yeah, I'm postulating here. I'm just wondering why that is.
We're back. Our guest today, Carl Johnson, Shadow Realms Demonology Handbook is out and available. We do have a link for that on today's program, so it's easy for you to find and access. Carl, talking about the different aspects of the paranormal, have you seen an actual physical manifestation of something you would call demonic?
Yes, I have.
Actually. How dramatic are they? I mean, is it Hollywood style creepy horns and cloven hoof, or how would you exactly, you know, qualify what you've seen?
What I've seen that fall into the demonic category or realm has been shadowy forms. It's called the shadow ghost, and whether they're demons or not, I don't know. They defy categorization. But I've seen a vaporous form that had arms and fingers and was basically anthropomorphic, meaning like a human form, and that was we determined that was demonic. Yes, I've seen a few of those things. It's rare, but maybe three times. I guess that's a lot of times to see a demonic entity. And Lana had an experience. It's detailed in the chapter Up Close and Personal with a Demon. And I talk about my encounter with a boy in Providence, a 14-year-old boy. But Lana describes her encounter with a demon that actually was a visual manifestation. And it's, I think it would have been easier if it had cloven hoofs and horns. You know, this thing was coming through her, and her family wasn't sure she wasn't hallucinating, but then they started seeing it, her family members. Her father was a minister. It was oozing through a door with a glass panel, and she saw something trying to, it looked like it was like dissolving through the materials of the door and coming in. And she said it looked like a desiccated corpse, kind of like a mummy, but had yellowish and red eyes, and kind of human, but not quite. Scaly skin, you know, bituminous ooze on appeared to be its skin. Just horrific, like nothing I've ever encountered or seen. It just cried out demonic, and that was coming right through, and she screamed. In fact, her story is illustrated in an episode of Paranormal Witness. We can say television show names, can't we?
Certainly. Yes, we can. Yeah. Say whatever you want. We don't pitch you.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, Paranormal Witness on the Sci-Fi Channel. It's still rated as the scariest of the top five rated episodes, you know, determined to be the scariest. Well, it's that episode is called Deliver Us from Evil. And it talks about Lana's family's ordeal. And they illustrate that quite well in this show, show the demon coming through at her. But it must have been worse to really experience that. You know, it left her shaken.
Here's something I'm curious about, right? We've done so many different shows, and we've done true crime programs. And there's a new Netflix series called The Bundy. I think it's like the Ted Bundy tapes. And when we did a show about Ted Bundy a while ago on True Crime Tuesday, we were talking with the author of the book, and he said, you know, that this isn't in my book, but this was reported by the attorneys in his presence at one point when they had found the bodies of one of the girls, and it kind of broke out in court about this. They said that Ted physically began to change his physical appearance, and this like rotting smell began to emanate from him. It wasn't feces. It wasn't anything that they could put a finger on, but they could smell this. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. This author's giving that take. I watched the trailer for the Bundy tapes, and one of the people on the video goes, Ted Bundy had the bluest of eyes, but in an instant they would turn black.
Yes, they would turn black.
Now, I mean, that was chilling. That's part of this actual true crime documentary. They're actually, you know, mentioning that aspect of it. Is that then would you say that in that case, a Ted Bundy is somebody that was possessed by the devil? Or do you believe that it might be more likely that he just was a demonic force in human form as opposed to being a possessed person? He may have.
Oh, that is so interesting.
A demon.
Yeah. To speculate about. Now, I think the human mind, the human psychology is capable of immense evil on its own. But yeah, let's see. Ted Bundy not just was in league with the demon. I believe Ted Bundy and other what we call serial killers actually personified the demon, like to the point where there's little separation between the human mind, the human presence, and the demon. They essentially house the demon. You know, because that is a thrill to them. That is empowerment. And it's like, demon, do what you will through me. Because there's aberrant human psychology. Somebody doesn't have to be possessed by a demon to commit murder, serial murders. But yeah, there's an episode where somebody was so embroiled in evil and totally sociopathic and no empathy for another human being, that demon presence comes to the surface. And that's an instance where people can see it and recognize it. And that is endemic to somebody being taken over by an inhuman presence. The eyes become black. I've seen that. We have it on film. And the eyes just, even the sclera, the white of the eye just turns black, you know, or the iris will change color. That's an indication. That cannot be explained away by modern medical science, how that happens. But yeah, Ted Bundy, if you ever want to do another show about Ted Bundy specifically, I can recommend my sister Cynthia, because she's an authority on Theodore Bundy. You know, she'll give you names, dates, times. You want to do a show on Jack the Ripper, call my brother. But right. Kind of authorities well, in that. You know?
I thought that was such a chilling version of the story. And then to have it corroborated in a new documentary where they're saying, listen, you know, he had the bluest of eyes, but in a flash, they would turn black, inky black. And that's, you know, you think, okay, there's a demon in there. Once the demon is at that point, why wouldn't it just release him? Why wouldn't it get its laugh? It got Bundy arrested for all of this. Why wouldn't it just leave him and move on to somebody else to continue their killing ways?
Well, nobody wants to leave a good party, do they? You know.
Well, when you're in jail, it's not much of a good party, right? You're caught at that point.
No, but he became a repository for the demon, where the demon was comfortable with his presence and he was comfortable with the demon, until it was down to the wire and he realized he truly was going to be executed. And that he didn't want. So he actually was given a last communion. I mean, they had to use you know, like bread and juice, but he requested communion at the end of his life, and you know, trying to save his soul. But if he wasn't going to be executed, he certainly would have gone on killing. But and of course,
it is interesting, and you think about the fact that, I mean, he escaped. He was able to get all these people to do what he wanted. And in most instances, you would think, who would be dumb enough to fall for this? If there was a demonic influence, some kind of paranormal connection, that would make you wonder, you know, what exactly is this?
He certainly was chameleonic. He could, like, pose as a sane person and even a good person. And, yeah, but how did he get away with it so many times when they were watching him? It's like he had this preternatural presence about him, where he could get people to do his bidding. Now, somebody who is an apologist for, like, the phenomenon, who could say, well, maybe just because he was in a frenzy, his pupils would dilate and give the appearance of being black eyes. Huh? Possible, but when you look at these videos, you say, no, there's something up there. And I have seen that transformation of the eyes, and it's uncanny when it happens. And Ted Bundy wasn't in so much of a frenzy when his eyes would change, but the evil was pushing its way to the surface.
Creepy. And, that fact is very bizarre. Have you ever come in contact with somebody? You haven't been called into a case, but you come into contact with somebody, Carl, and in their presence, you start to realize, I think this person may be demonically charged. They may be possessed or oppressed, and they don't even realize it.
Yes, in fact, and it's not always when somebody's like, complaining of spiritual problems and thought to be possessed. Sometimes it's the person you see getting their paper in the morning. You're like, two doors down. An instance would be when, Lana, my co-author, Lana Brock, she is a pharmacy technician, and she was working in a CVS store. And actually, she wasn't even on the job at the time. She was in line, and there was a man next to her, and she just got a bad vibration about him. There was something. He wasn't doing anything untoward. And they made eye contact, and his eyes were black, and it didn't seem normal. There was something different about him. And she said, I just got such a bad feeling. I don't know why. I can't point on any specific feature except for his eyes being black, but there was something about him that was hostile. You know, he was acting normal, but there was something, I got a bad vibe about him. I just felt demon, because she's been around demonic presences. So, and then she got that spider sense, you know, tingling feeling. So, yeah, I think some people are walking around with some demonic baggage and you wouldn't necessarily know it.
Right.
It will erupt at some time in some way, some terrible way, perhaps. But they don't always give off all the signs.
Shadow Realms, Demonology Handbook by Carl Johnson and Lana Rock. We have a link up to that on today's program. Carl, it's always great catching up. Thank you so much for joining us again today, and hopefully it won't be so many years between visits again.
Right. Seems like we just got started. Like, oh, you're going now? What? What?
I know.
You're not breaking for commercial? By. Is that what you're doing?
We are out of time, but I appreciate your visit, and we'll come back again. And you know, it might be nice to visit with you and your brother simultaneously to hear. I loved when we used to have those rare shows and the two of you bouncing back and forth. So perhaps we can work that out here in the near future to connect again. But thank you so much for spending some time with us, Carl.
That we can manage, and I look forward to it, Dave.
Thank you very much. And everybody,
take
remember,
care. You're great.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Remember, on Tuesday, we're back. True Crime Tuesday. John Ferrick will be with us. This is an ongoing case. In John is really very compelled to share this story. Samantha Herrer, the 911 dispatcher that was murdered. And he said this is turning out to be a very Lacey Peterson, Scott Peterson-like case that's unfolding. So we'll cover that on Tuesday. Make sure you you tune in. If you haven't already subscribed, it's very easy. Just go to darknessradio.com, click on the True Crime Tuesday banner. You'll be able to subscribe right from there. Never miss another minute in the best of True Crime Talk Radio every Tuesday. And when you subscribe, that $4.99 a month gets you access to all the new programming and all of our back catalog going over the last two and a half years. So make sure you go subscribe now for the best of True Crime Talk Radio. For the best in paranormal talk radio, I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. We'll see you again right here next weekend.